Welcome our speaker for tonight, Colleen from Philadelphia.
Hi, everyone. Hi, I'm Colleen Joy. I am definitely an alcoholic. And thank you all for coming out on Memorial Day. Happy Memorial Day. I hope everyone enjoyed their day off from work, but also found time to remember the meaning of Memorial Day. So I'm an alcoholic, and that's why I'm here, and that's why all of you are here. And I thought I had a really boring story, and then I realized that the more interesting part of my story is the time I've been sober. It's been a wild ride, and it's been amazing, and my life is definitely one beyond my wildest dreams. I should tell you three very important things about myself before I get too far into this. I have a sobriety date. That is August 27th, 2007. I have a home group. That is the Underground Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday at 8 p.m. All are welcome. We'd love to have you down at 4th and Lombard. And I have a sponsor, Shar R. from New Jersey, and she has a sponsor, and she has a sponsor. And I love my grand sponsor because she wears awesome shoes. She's been sober way before I was born, and she's a grandmother, and the first time I met her, I was like, those are awesome heels. So my line of sponsorship wears good clothes. No, just kidding. It's important. It was important for me to find people that were like me when I first started coming around. And I'm a little sad about this story. When my second meeting in, I ran into a girl that I ran really hard with. We drank together. We did interesting things in public together. We were very tight, and she disappeared. And I actually thought she was dead. Like, I hadn't seen her. She wasn't returning phone calls. And it was about five years ago, I started coming to meetings. And I saw her at that second meeting, and I said to myself, and I knew in my heart, I was like, wow, if this girl can do it, I can do it. And just her presence at that second meeting that I ever went to, ever, made me come back to my third day of AA. So it's important that I show up. It's important that we all show up. We never know what, you know, what just our presence can do for someone else in the rooms. So I came in June of 2007, and it took me a while to get it. My first month in the rooms, I maybe had, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 days at a time. And I kept showing up to the Tuesday meeting of my home group, which is a beginner's meeting. And you know, hi, my name is Colleen Joy. I'm an alcoholic. I've got 2 days. Hi, my name is Colleen Joy. I'm an alcoholic. I've got 5 days. Hi, my name is Colleen Joy. I'm an alcoholic. I've got 1 day. And they kept welcoming me back. Like, I was sure that they were going to, like, look, you're not getting this. You should really stop coming. I was positive that that was going to happen. And it never did. And I've never gone to a meeting where that has happened. And I've never done that to anyone else. And I really appreciate when people say, you know, keep coming back. It works if you work it. It works if you work it. Because it really does. And like I said, my life is, you know, I have my problems, but my life is really cool right now. So I love it up here. I love this meeting outside. I love being able to look amongst the field while I'm talking. I grew up in the suburbs, and where my dad is a builder. So he built the house that I grew up in, which was a really cool experience. And I got, as a four-year-old, I got to help build the house that we grew up in. I was sweeping the floors, and I was he would point, and I would move something from one corner to the next, anything to make me feel productive. But at that house, there were farm fields like this that stretched out from the perimeters, and there was always fireflies in the summertime. And it was always one of the most beautiful things that I can remember from my childhood. And as a sober woman, I look back on my childhood. It was amazing. It was absolutely spectacular. We were always out in the fields. I was always riding a bike. I had really good friends. I'm still friends with some of those people from that old neighborhood. And my parents made sure that we didn't want for anything. And something was weird. You know, when I look back on it now, I see the joy. And I've done a couple fourth steps. So, like, that onion has been peeled back, and I've gotten to the core of a lot of root issues. And it's given me the blessing and the ability to look at my childhood in such a different light. But while I was in that childhood, it was a much different story. I have three older brothers, and there was a big gap between my brothers and I. My brothers are 18 months apart from each other, and then the youngest is 4 years older than I am. So when we were all like 12 and younger, we were all kind of the same age. We were all doing the same things. We were all playing in the mud. We were all on bikes. And my brothers, one by one, entered junior high and then high school. And then there was a point where I was in junior high and my brothers were all in college. And I very much felt like an only child. And there was something about that felt right, because I'd always, as loud and boisterous as I can be and always have been, my attitude and personality is very much a deflection from this shy part of me that really doesn't know how to read people. It doesn't know how to talk to people. If someone comes up to talk to me, it's like, what do you want? Like, I didn't do it. Like, that's actually several interesting stories. But I just didn't get some things. And I was really jealous of some of my friends and their families, because I had this imagination that they were living in perfect houses. And as wonderful as I know my childhood rocked. You know, I've heard lots of other people's stories, and I have friends, and we talk about different things all the time. You know, I had a good growing up, but my parents fought a lot, and it was strange. They would fight in the middle of the night. And my dad's voice was always this very low, calm river, very, you know, very calming. And my mom would just scream at the top of her lungs. And one of my brothers would yell from their bedroom, like, shut up. And then that would turn into, you shut up. And then someone else would know, yo, you shut up. And it's like, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Like, what's going on? And then we would wake up the next morning. Mom and Dad would be having coffee in their breakfast nook. Nothing happened, and I'm supposed to ignore the iron that's sitting in a pile of glass that she threw at him and broke the penny jar. Like, we're not going to talk about that. We're not even going to identify it as something that actually happened. I'm just going to go to school, and I'm going to mingle with all my friends who I already don't relate to, and we're not going to talk about anything. And that was like, hey, childhood. The interesting, and that's not even the interesting thing that happened. The interesting thing that happened was when I was 13, my mom broke her ankle in such a devastating manner that amputation was actually on the table. It was rough, and she was in and out of. She was in and out of surgery for about 7 years, and my dad took over as mom and dad. I took over with a lot of things, and I really didn't have that relationship with my mom. And God bless my father, because my brothers were in college and they were doing their own thing, I was, you know, doing as much as I could while still being indignant and telling him how much I was doing. And, you know, he had a daughter going through puberty and a wife going through menopause. And, you know, meanwhile, the whole chemistry of the house is just haywire. I have since made amends to my dad, and we laugh about it. But there's a, you know, there's a huge gap in the pivotal part of my upbringing where I didn't have a mom. You know, I would come home from school, and I would walk along the walls for fear that she would hear that I was home, because I was going to get it. I was going to get a tongue lashing. I was going to, you know, I was going to be told what I'm not doing right. I was going to be told how, you know, you need to do this and you need to do that. And high school quickly became a game of get through and get out. And I did that. I got into a wonderful college. I went to art school, and if anyone here has gone to art school to me meant drink and make pretty things. And I was very good at that. I should back up a minute. My first drink, I didn't get blasted. I didn't black out. It wasn't like a huge deal. But I definitely relate to the principle of drinking because you're full of resentment. My parents renewed their 25th anniversary wedding vows, and they did it at like this cute little country club in Westchester, and there was all of our friends and family, and there was a ceremony. We all stood up and we lit candles and we raised our hands and like we praised my parents' marriage. And I'm standing up there about to jump out of my skin because I'm like, one of them almost pushed the other down the stairs last night. Like, no one here knows what I know. Like, no one here gets. Like, this is a sham. Like, how dare they stand before God at this country club and tell everyone how great their marriage is? They've been married for 25 years. Like, what the F? So then I drank that night, and I was totally fine with the whole wedding vow renewal thing. Like, this is great. I was the youngest of the group of cousins I was hanging out with, and I was the most agile, so it was my job. I was being of service, and I was being helpful. It was my job to sneak up the deck steps, slip my hand through the railing, and pull beers out of the ice bucket and bring them back downstairs to the basement through the back door. So that was my first experience being of service, and it was really purposeful given the next 13 years of my life. And it is a simple principle of my high school that it is easier to obtain other substances than it is to obtain alcohol. And sometimes those other substances were chain smoking a pack of Reds as fast as I could because I knew that gave me a buzz. Sometimes, you know, that other substance was when I first got my driver's license, the first thing I did was go to the pharmacy and got a bottle of Tylenol PM. You know, I'm not just talking about illegal substances. I'm talking about anything to get me out of my house because I was, you know, I was physically unable to support myself. Like, it wasn't possible. I lived out in the boondocks. Like, I didn't have city blocks where I could walk to hook up with friends. I hear people's stories, and they're like, yeah, we jumped out the window, and we walked down the street, and we did all this stuff. I was like, there was farmland. So, like, as soon as I got my license, man, I found different creative ways to take myself out. God, please take me out. That was my prayer when I was, before I got sober. Take me out. And today, my prayer is take me out of the equation. And it's just such a different feeling to know what my prayer was and what my prayer is today. So, college was fun. Get drunk. Make cool things. I am a photographer by trade. And I went to work immediately after college. College was interesting. College was my introduction to some more creative chemically engineered drugs. College was my introduction to money, really. I was given a settlement when I was 18 from something that happened when I was 4. I have a scar on my face from falling on someone else's property. And when I was 18, I was given quite a large sum of money for an 18-year-old. And in so many words, I was told this money is supposed to make me feel better. I'm like, oh, that's why I never connected to people, because I never had this money. So just, you know, living above my means. Of course, the money ran out. But living above my means, buying meals for people, buying friends, overextending myself, living in an apartment I really shouldn't have been living in for various reasons. Oh, we'll live together, it'll be platonic, don't worry. So we, in and out of my parents' house, like in one apartment, back in my parents' basement, in another apartment, back in my parents' basement. Finally, I was 23, when I finally got out of my parents' basement permanently. And I had this sensation, like, yeah, this is it. Like, I'm out of my parents' house. Like, totally, like, it's on. And it was. And it was great. You know, I quit my job. I lived off a credit card for a couple months. I started a business. The business took off like nothing anyone in the industry had seen. The guy that I left, his studio that I left, he called me just to kind of give me a jab. He's like, you know, I've already gotten two calls that have said they're also looking at you, you know, for this contract. I'm like, yeah, no big deal. Like, I'm surprised you didn't shut down when I left. And just hubris all over the place. Like, it's a 23-year-old starting a business is a dangerous combination. And what's even more dangerous is if the business is successful. And it was. And I had a Center City office, and I had a Center City apartment, and I had a drug dealer that made call, like that came around to my office. I didn't have to go to his smarmy little place. Like, he delivered, and it was great. And I still felt the exact same way I felt when I would have to go to school with the memory of that clothes iron in that pile of glass. Like, I wasn't talking about something. I wasn't identifying anything. I was baseline functioning, you know, barely brushing my teeth, barely showering, showing up to meet with clients with the Irish shower, you know, perfume everywhere. Oh, I'm clean. And having my senses restored, like I now have a sense of smell. Like, I quit smoking a couple years ago, and I have a sense of smell. And I, like, if you're smoking pot, I can smell it. And I can't imagine me showing up to some of these clients' house and them not knowing that I was stoned. Like, hindsight can be horrifying sometimes, because I smoke pot all the time because I felt it was safer to smoke pot while driving instead of drinking while driving. That was my logic. I don't recommend it. The fall of 2005, things fell apart. My office got broken into. And although that's a very circumstantial thing, it was really the pin on the grenade. And I held on to that grenade for dear life for another year and a half. It was the start of panic attacks, and I would only have panic. Well, I had a panic attack in the middle of 30th Street Station, going out to my parents' house, and it was the most bizarre thing. I thought I was having a heart attack, and I was like, should I go over and talk to this police officer? But I'm kind of high, like I could get in trouble. So I'm just gonna sit here and finish having this panic attack for like an hour and a half, because I missed my train. And the panic attacks kept coming. I was dating a guy at the time who recommended that I go to therapy. And I thought, He said you have to go to therapy because you have to reconcile this stuff with your mom. All right, that's fair. I agree, she's the root of all my problems. I called her up and I told her she was the root of all my problems, just in case there was any, like, any misunderstanding about it. And she took it very well. She scooped me up and took me to her doctor and was like, please look at my daughter, please. So I'm in therapy. My mom drags me to her doctor. I describe to my mom's doctor how I got in a fight with my boyfriend, didn't have any drugs, went to the corner store, got a six-pack of Modelo because I'm fancy and I drink beer with my pinky out. That's because that means I'm not an alcoholic. If you drink beer with your pinky out, you're totally safe. So I describe to him, I go and I get a six-pack of Modelo. I get back to my house. I drink it as fast as I can. I don't get drunk, so I take my pillow and I beat my bed until the bed frame falls apart. And he said, let's do a blood test. What? No, like, have you thought about AA? Nothing. Like, no mention of it. And in hindsight, yay, because I was not ready at that point. So he did a blood test, and he found a condition. One of the symptoms is erratic behavior. Great! I'm fixed. I'm going to take this medication. My erratic behavior is going to be solved, and I can keep drinking. Like, awesome. At the same time, I started to use cocaine. And that expedited my recovery lightning fast, lightning fast. I bought a house because drug addicts don't own homes. So I'm all about doing things that drug addicts don't do or don't have. So I bought a house because that was a great idea. And actually, in hindsight, it was a fabulous idea. I love my home. I hated it for the longest time. It took a lot of inventory to be comfortable in that home that I did drugs in and had to get sober in, because it's not like an apartment. I can't move. I was locked in. Like, I can't go anywhere. I have to get sober here. All those geographical things, moving from East Falls to Center City to, you know, living in the office, all the times I was back and forth from, you know, apartments with roommates to my mom's house and back. All of that was circumstantial geographical changes, and I was stuck in a house that, like, I had to make a decision. I had to make a change. And God bless that therapist. She sat for a year and a half and didn't open her mouth once about AA until I said that I couldn't stop. I didn't know how to stop. And it was like her eyes lit up. She got this, like, she didn't want to smile too hard, but she was excited. She was like, oh, she's in that spot. Maybe she's ready. I'm just going to tell her about this one meeting. So I came in on a Thursday, and she had the AA meeting schedule for Center City printed out. And I picked one. It was a 7 o'clock meeting on a Thursday. And I'm going to go to that meeting. And by the time that meeting rolled around later on that evening, I was no longer drunk or high, so I figured I didn't have to go. So I was like, wait a minute, let me put this in my calendar, because I'm super organized, because drug addicts and alcoholics aren't organized. So I put in my calendar in my Microsoft Outlook, and I set an alarm. So every Thursday at 6:45, this alarm would ring. And as long as I was sober, when that little reminder bell rang, I didn't have to go to this meeting. So I would be as sober as I could on Thursday. That little alarm bell would ding. I didn't have to go to that meeting. I would go out and party with friends and do X substance. And then on Friday, I would do Y substance to bring me back down from X substance. And then Saturday, I would lay low a little bit. Sunday, I would go out and party again. Monday, I usually took Monday off because I'm a working professional and I deserve Mondays off, people, let me tell you. Tuesdays, I would work as hard as I could. Wednesday, I couldn't keep it together, so I would take something to take the edge off. And then Thursday, as long as I was sober by that bell, I didn't have to go to AA. And that was 9 months. 9 months from when she told me about that I could go to AA to when I actually stepped foot in a meeting. That's how I lived. As long as X, I don't have to do Y. All the time. I still catch myself setting those limitations for myself. But so I walk into the room, and it's a seventh tradition meeting, and I'm still sober today, so That meeting was so funny. The guys were, it was a bunch of men. They were hanging out front of the church, all smoking cigarettes. I walk in right by them. I don't say hi. The room is empty. So I like, oh, meeting's canceled. So I walk back out, and this guy grabs me by the wrist, and he goes, "We know why you're here. You might as well stay." And I attended my first meeting, and it was horrifying because someone that I knew walked in. I was like, oh, my God. And then I realized he's here, too. So that was comforting, but ultimately terrifying, whole thing terrifying. Nothing but men with tattoos and, like, grunty voices, and I'm clearly not an alcoholic. I don't look like any of these guys. Ding! So the same guy that grabbed my wrist before I went into the meeting stayed and talked with me for about an hour and a half after the meeting. And he's like, look, there's a lot of good women at this meeting, down the street on Tuesdays. You should go. I don't know why I went, but I went. And I went to two meetings that day. I went to a 5:30. After the 5:30, they kidnapped me, and I went to the 8, and that's where I saw my friend who is no longer in the rooms, but she was enough to keep me in the rooms for as long as I needed to be there. And it was tough. I have the spiritual experience of the educational variety. I was not struck by lightning. There were no burning bushes. It was a lot of hard, sometimes unnecessary work on my part. Like I said, the first month, I couldn't stay sober. And a very good friend of mine, who I'm still friends with today, God love her, she said, why don't you try an IOP? Because I couldn't go to rehab because I'm a wedding photographer. I had all these wedding contracts that I had to fulfill. Like, I couldn't leave town. They would find me. And she suggested IOP. And I was so insulted by this that I stayed sober for 34 days. My sobriety date is really, really important to me. And I'm really good with dates. I remember dates very well. And the last time I consumed alcohol was July 18th of that summer. And it was at Delilah's Den. If you'd like to hear that story, I'd be happy to tell you after the meeting. But that was the last time I consumed alcohol. I can tell you the last time I consumed Coke. I can tell you the last time I did X, Y, and Z. But my sobriety date's August 27th, and it's not because of alcohol. But I knew in my heart that I could not carry a message of, you know, I could not carry my experience, strength, and hope to the newcomer if I had this lingering knowledge that I was still, you know, trying to take myself out with chemicals. I was still trying to take myself out of the moment. So, you know, the night of the 26th, I was at a bar restaurant that I shouldn't have been at, and I was watching my friends who were in a variety show, and I shouldn't have been hanging out with them. And, you know, a friend of mine passed me his peace pipe, and that was cool, and I didn't think twice. You know, I had 2 months of AA in my head. You know, all 2 months, woo! And it wasn't enough. Just as important as showing up is, just showing up wasn't enough. And I woke up the next day without a hangover. I didn't do a lot. It wasn't like a huge bender. It wasn't a free-for-all. I wasn't drunk driving. I woke up the next morning with the worst feeling that I had ever felt to that point. Like, what am I doing? I'm just going to keep going in this circle unless I change something. So at the time, I had two sponsors because I believed that I was really, really sick and I needed that much special attention. Neither one of the sponsors knew about each other. And one sponsor was taking me through the 12 and 12, and the other sponsor was taking me through the big book. And I really wasn't committed to anything. And I graciously told the sponsor taking me through the 12 and 12 that I was going to work with my other secret sponsor. And she just laughed. She's like, all right, go nuts. And When I first started working the steps, I was working with this woman through the 12 and 12. And I am sure this experience works for some people, but it did not work for me. I did not experience any sort of relief until I started reading the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with another sober member with experience going and living through the steps. And I hear people joke that I was fast-tracked. I was through the steps within 4 months, and I had a sponsee, and I dumped all of that sponsee's beer down the sink, which I don't recommend, because I'm just going to get more beer. So, you know, I'm 4 months sober. I'm sponsoring people. I got my fireman's helmet on with my axe, and I'm going to go into that burning building, and I'm going to save alcoholics, man, and it's going to be great. And I'm going to stay sober, and you're going to stay sober, because I'm going to beat you with this big book. And that's how we're both going to stay sober. And, you know, one day in January, I've got 4 or so months clean. I'm sitting at my home group. I'm going to pack up all my stuff first. I'm going to be the first one out of this, put on my hat, walk out the door, and I'm going to go to my friend's house, and I'm going to do substances. And because I'm tired of this. It's not working. I'm miserable. I'm sponsoring people, and nothing's happening. Like, my checkbook is still balanced. My heat isn't on. Like, hello. What you have, I don't want. But I don't really have a perception. I can't really see properly. I don't really know what you have because I'm not really in AA. I'm just kind of on this, like, perimeter. So somehow a girlfriend of mine magically teleported herself from inside the meeting to outside the meeting. And she was smoking a cigarette. She probably slipped out, like the real part of the story. And she said, "Oh, hi, Colleen, how are you?" And I just start crying, projectile crying, like sobbing, belly over, like, ah! And she has no idea what to do. She's like, "Oh, do you want to go inside and say the seventh step prayer together?" I don't know what that means. Like, I wasn't practicing. Like, I'd done a fourth step. I'd done an eighth step. I made 2 amends. There was really nothing else in between. There was really nothing else going on. So we go inside and we say the seventh step prayer, and I'm like, "It didn't work." And she's like, "That's not the point. These are experiences that we have. You're going to tell this story later, and it's going to help people. You know, like, you can't judge what the rest of your sobriety is going to look like based on how you feel right now." And I didn't. And it stopped me in my tracks, and I started to work with a sponsor that took me through the steps in a very academic way. I was pen to paper on step one, writing what I was powerless over, writing why my life was unmanageable, and, you know, going over these things together. It took me maybe 9 months to get through the steps that second time, while still sponsoring people, while still showing up to meetings, while still doing what I could do with my knowledge of the 12 steps. But, man, it blew the doors off, you know, having... For someone who has always judged herself as stupid, for someone who always thought she was never diagnosed properly with ADD, to sit down and have this academic experience to learn these principles and to use outside sources, I think that's great. You know, I use non-AA meditation books and, stuff like that. And I love reading spiritual material, like, to welcome that into my program and to really live these 12 steps, like, and study them so that I know what the F I'm talking about. If I heard someone say something really cool at a meeting, it was like I would put that in the piggy bank for the next time I had to share. And there really wasn't anything original that came out of my mouth, you know, until I really started to learn and study the steps and how they could help me. And it worked so well that, you know, 2.5 years sober, I'm in the same position I was when, when I was 4 months sober. I had the same sensation. I was crazy. I was, You know, my checkbook was still bounced. My finances were a wreck. I'm living the dream, and I'm happy over here, but I'm miserable over here. And I really want these things to be the same thing. Like, I want one emotion at once. Like, please, like, can this happen? And I was stuck in a traffic jam on the Walt Whitman Bridge, and I thought it was a good idea to throw myself off the bridge. 2.5 years sober, this is how I'm going to fix this. This feeling that I have, I'm just going to take myself out. You know, I reverted back to that primitive prayer, and then I remembered, God, take me out of the equation. And traffic started moving, and I got to my sponsor's house, and we started talking, and I really had to get honest about what was going on. And I believe the reason we do inventory, I have to inventory anything that makes me want to drink. And resentments are the number one offender. So if I'm filled with resentments and I want to drink, I have to inventory these resentments so that I can be relieved and I can have this drain pulled so that the spirit can flow through me so that I can pass it on to other people. Well, my finances were an issue. And living a life where I had this business and the Center City office and the Center City apartment and all this stuff, and then losing it, and then reeling up tens of thousands of dollars of debt, and just being at the bottom, and like, there's no way out, I'm never going to get out of debt, this is, you know, I'm such a disgrace to AA, I'm not fixed. So it was suggested that I start inventorying my money. I didn't like that at all. And I'm like, well, that's not in the big book. That's not what it says. It says fears, resentments, sex conduct. It doesn't say that. I'm a big book girl. And I love the 12 and 12. I hope I don't offend anybody by loving the 12 and 12, but whew. Also, this is page 51. Fourth step out of the 12 and 12. Also of importance for most alcoholics are the questions they must ask about their behavior respecting finance and emotional security. In these areas, fear, greed, possessiveness, and pride have too often done their worst. Surveying their business and employment record, almost any alcoholic can ask questions like these. In addition to my drinking problem, what character defects contributed to my financial instability? Did fear and inferiority about my fitness for my job destroy my confidence and fill me with conflict? Did I try to cover up those feelings of inadequacy by bluffing, cheating, lying, or evading responsibility? Or by griping that others failed to recognize my true exceptional abilities? Did I overvalue myself and play the big shot? Did I have such unprincipled ambition that I double-crossed and undercut my associates? Was I extravagant?
I just swallowed a bug.
All right. Woo! Was I extravagant? Did I recklessly borrow money, caring little whether I paid it back or not? For the record, I'm pointing at myself for that. Was I a pinch penny, refusing to support my family properly? Did I cut corners financially? What about the quick money deals, the stock market, and the races? And I had to inventory my money. I had to inventory why I spent it. I had to inventory where it was going. And today I do it's a version of a 10th step for me, you know, what I spent during the day and what I earned. And, man, God is in the numbers. You know, I look at those numbers and I accumulate them, and I'm not, like, obsessive about it. Like, it's a notebook, and then the notebook goes into a spreadsheet. I look at it once a month, and I can look at those numbers and I know where I'm at, and my biggest financial amends is to the IRS, and they know exactly where I am, and I do not hide from them, and we are making arrangements, which is great, which is absolutely phenomenal. I was so afraid of the big bad wolf that jumping off a bridge was a bright idea, and today I call them before they call me, and that's amazing. And I haven't used a credit card since April 15th, 2010. And I haven't incurred unsecured debt in a very long time. And, you know, this is clean living. Like, someone once told me, you know, in regards to steps 8 and 9, that, you know, the trick to happy sobriety is to honestly be conscious and not create new amends that you have to make. I was in a situation with a person a while ago where they made amends to me for something, and they blatantly said, "I did this because I knew I could make amends for it later." Okay, I'm not going to respond to that. And it was frustrating because I see people live like that sometimes, and I'm like, it's not judgment, it's sadness, because I used to live like that. Like, I, you know, the 15th of April, July, October, you know, when quarterly tax day came, and I would not get out of bed on those days because I knew I had 8 hours to submit a quarterly tax payment. And, you know, I never did. I literally curled up and I hid from everything. And, you know, today, it's hard, it's so hard to approach a situation where you could go left or you could go right, and going right is just so much easier, and I can make amends for it later. Like, really sorry, dude, I'm not gonna do what I know is right, because I got this program and I can clean it up and I'll stay on my side of the street. It is so hard to go that high road. It's so hard. I have a client right now that I haven't returned the last two calls. I'm just gonna call myself out, and now I'm gonna call her tomorrow because I'm talking about it on tape. I haven't returned the last two calls that she's given me, and it's not because I don't have what she paid for. It's not because I don't like her. It's because I have a fear that I didn't do a good enough job on what she paid me to do. Ah, crippling, right? Like, I'm an artist. Everything I should do should be pretty. And I look at the work I did, and I'm like, it could have been better. And now I think she hates me, and I'm not going to return her calls. And I'm back under that rock. And I'm back living in fear. And I'm back not at that crossroad, going the easy road, because I can make amends for it later. And that's not how I live today. You know, that life beyond my wildest dreams that I was talking about is freedom. There's so much freedom in my life, and it is not perfect. I still have tens of thousands of dollars in debt. Actually, I have the same amount of debt that I had when I wanted to throw myself off that bridge 2.5 years ago. Same amount. Almost to the penny, same amount. And I wanted to die then, and I really don't want to die now. So it's not circumstance, it's perception. You know, I really got into the work with this finance stuff. I can apply AA to anything. You know, trouble with your finances, why don't you apply AA to it? Trouble with my family, why don't you apply AA to it? Great. You know, if like the handbook that no one ever thinks they got when they were a kid, like, we got it now. It's 164 pages right there. Like, that's the handbook that I never thought I had, and now I have it today, and I can use it freely. And, you know, today I've traveled all over the place as a photographer. I've seen amazing things. Glacier National Park in Montana. I was in Brazil a year or so ago. I have an amazing man in my life that takes me to these places, and it's not because there's any expectation. It's because, like, he believes that I deserve to go and see these beautiful things. And it's It's such a blessing to love and to be loved and to not have to prove myself. I don't have to show you why I'm lovable. I'm just lovable, you know, and I'm just gonna let it flow. Like, I previously did a lot of judgment. Judged a lot of people, why they were better than me, why they weren't like me, why they were less than me, how I was better than them. And today it's a lot of, that's cool. You know, I still have my moments, but it's so much more freedom to just be who I am, to accept myself, to not be afraid to present myself in whatever form I'm in, and to be amongst like-minded people who are just trying to do the same thing. Like, get another day, stay sober, carry the message, love your higher power, and reach your hand out to someone who needs it. So, that's all I have. Thanks for letting me share, guys.